Anti-anecdotalism. Nicholas G. Carr, journalist, author, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. We live anecdotally, proceeding from birth to death through a series of incidents, but scientists can be quick to dismiss the value of anecdotes. Anecdotal has become something of a curse word, at least when applied to research and other explorations of the real. A personal story, in this view, is a distraction or a distortion, something that gets in the way of a broader, statistically rigorous analysis of a large set of observations or a big pile of data. But as this year's Edge question makes clear, the line between the objective and the subjective falls short of the Euclidean ideal. It's negotiable. The empirical, if it's to provide anything like a full picture, needs to make room for both the statistical and the anecdotal. The danger in scorning the anecdotal is that science gets too far removed from the actual experience of life, losing sight of the fact that mathematical averages and other such measures are always abstractions. Some prominent physicists have recently questioned the need for philosophy, implying that it's been rendered obsolete by scientific inquiry. I wonder if that opinion isn't a symptom of anti-anecdotalism. Philosophers, poets, artists, their raw material includes the anecdote, and they remain, even more so than scientists, our best guides to what it means to exist. Science makes philosophy obsolete. Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein.
The obsolescence of philosophy is often taken to be a consequence of science. After all, science has a history of repeatedly inheriting and definitively answering questions over which philosophers have futilely hemmed and hawed for unconscionable amounts of time. It's been that way from the beginning. Those irrepressible ancient Greeks, Thales and company, in speculating about the ultimate constituents of the physical world and the laws that govern its changes, were asking questions that awaited answers from physics and cosmology. And so it has gone, science transforming philosophy's vagaries into empirically testable theories, right down to our own scientifically explosive period, when the advancement of cognitive and affective neuroscience has brought such questions as the nature of consciousness, free will, and morality, those perennials of the philosophy curriculum, under the gaze of fMRI-enhanced scientists. Philosophy's role in the business of knowledge, or so goes the story, is to send up a signal reading, "Science desperately needed here," or, changing the metaphor, philosophy is a cold storage room in which questions are shelved until the sciences get around to handling them. Or, to change the metaphor yet again, philosophers are premature ejaculators who decant too soon, spilling their seminal genius to no effect. Choose your metaphor. The moral of the story is that the history of scientific expansion is the history of philosophical contraction, and the natural progression ends in the elimination of philosophy. What's wrong with this story? Well, for starters, it's internally incoherent. You can't argue for science making philosophy obsolete without indulging in philosophical arguments. You're going to need to argue, for example, for a clear criterion for distinguishing between scientific and non-scientific theories of the world. When pressed for an answer to the so-called demarcation problem, scientists almost automatically reach for the notion of falsifiability first proposed by Karl Popper. His profession? Philosophy. But whatever criterion you offer, its defense is going to implicate you in philosophy. Likewise, with the unavoidable question, especially for those who argue philosophy's obsolescence, of what it is we're doing in doing science. Are we offering descriptions of reality, and so extending our ontology in discovering the entities and forces utilized in our best scientific theories? Have we learned, as scientific realism would have it, that there are genes and neurons, pheromones and bosons, perhaps a multiverse? Or are these theoretical terms not meant to be interpreted as references to things in the world at all, but as mere metaphorical gears in the instruments of prediction known as theories? Presumably, scientists care about the philosophical question of whether they're actually talking about anything other than observations when they do their science. Even more to the point, the view that science eliminates philosophy requires a philosophical defense of scientific realism. And if you think not, then that's going to require a philosophical argument. A triumphalist scientism needs philosophy to support itself. And the lesson here should be generalized. Philosophy is joined to science in reason's project. Its mandate is to render our views and our attitudes maximally coherent. This involves it in the task of, in Wilfred Sellers' terms, reconciling the scientific and the manifest images we have of our being in the world, which also involves philosophy in providing the reasoning that science requires in order to claim its image as descriptive. Perhaps the old demarcation problem of distinguishing the scientific is misguided. The more important demarcation is distinguishing all that is implicated in and reconcilable with the scientific claims of knowledge. This leads me to hazard a more utopian answer to this year's Edge question than the one I proposed in the title. What idea should science retire? The idea of science itself. Let's retire it in favor of the more inclusive knowledge.
Science. Ian Bogost, video game designer. Ivan Allen, College Distinguished Chair in Media Studies and Professor of Interactive Computing, Georgia Institute of Technology. Author, Alien Phenomenology. No topic is left unexplored, reads the jacket blurb of The Science of Orgasm, a 2006 book by an endocrinologist, a neuroscientist, and a sexologist. A list of topics covered includes the genital-brain connection and how the brain produces orgasms. The result, promises the jacket blurb, illuminates the hows, whats, and wherefores of orgasm. Its virtues or faults notwithstanding, the science of orgasm exemplifies a trend that has become nearly ubiquitous in popular discourse, that a topic can be best and most thoroughly understood from the vantage point of science. How common is this approach? Google Books produces nearly 150 million search results for the phrase, "the science of," including dozens of books with the quip in their titles. The Science of Smarter Spending, The Science of Acting, The Science of Champagne, The Science of Fear, The Science of Composing, the list goes on. The Science of X is one example of the rhetoric of science, the idea that anything called science is science, but not the only one. There's also Scientists Have Shown, or its commoner shorthand, Studies Show. Phrases that appeal to the authority of science, whether or not the conclusions they summarize bear any resemblance to the purported studies from which those conclusions were derived. Both of these tendencies could rightly be accused of scientism, the view that empirical science entails the most complete, authoritative, and valid approach to answering questions about the world. Scientism isn't a new erroneous notion, but it's an increasingly popular one. Recently, Stephen Hawking pronounced philosophy dead because it hasn't kept up with advances in physics. Scientism assumes that the only productive way to understand the universe is through the pursuit of science, and that all other activities are lesser at best, pointless at worst. And to be sure, the rhetoric of science has arisen partly thanks to scientism. Science of X books and research findings, traceable to an origin in apparently scientific experimentation, increasingly take the place of philosophical, interpretive, and reflective accounts of the meaning and importance of activities of all kinds. Instead of pondering the social uses of sparkling wine and its pleasures, we ponder what the size of its bubbles indicates about its quality, or why that effervescence lasts longer in a modern fluted glass than in a wider champagne coupe. But the rhetoric of science doesn't just risk the descent into scientism. It also gives science sole credit for something it doesn't deserve credit for, an attention to the construction and operation of things. Most of the Science of X books look at the material form of their subject, be it neurochemical, computational, or economic. But attention to the material realities of the subject has no necessary relationship to science at all. Literary scholars study the history of the book, including its material evolution from clay tablet to papyrus to codex. Artists rely on a deep understanding of the physical mediums of pigment, marble, or optics when they fashion creations. Chefs require a sophisticated grasp of the chemistry and biology of food in order to thrive in their craft. To think that science has a special relationship to observations about the material world isn't just wrong, it's insulting. Beyond encouraging people to see science as the only direction for human knowledge and absconding with the subject of materiality, the rhetoric of science also does a disservice to science itself. It makes science look simple, easy, and fun when it's mostly complex, difficult, and monotonous. A case in point. The popular Facebook page, I Fucking Love Science, posts quick-take variations on the Science of X theme, mostly images and short descriptions of unfamiliar creatures, like the pink fairy armadillo, or illustrated birthday wishes to famous scientists like Hawking. But as the science fiction writer John Schuyler rightly insisted in a fiery takedown of the practice last year, most people don't fucking love science. They fucking love photography, pretty images of fairy armadillos, and renowned physicists. The pleasure derived from these pictures obviates the public's need to understand how science actually gets done, slowly and methodically, with little acknowledgement and modest pay in unseen laboratories and research facilities. The rhetoric of science has consequences. Things that have no particular relation to scientific practice must increasingly frame their work in scientific terms to earn any attention or support. The sociology of Internet use suddenly transformed into web science. Long-accepted practices of statistical analysis have become data science. Thanks to shifting educational and research funding priorities, anyone who can't claim membership in a STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math field, will be left out in the cold. Unfortunately, the rhetoric of science offers the tactical response to such new challenges. Unless humanists reframe their work as literary science, they risk being marginalized, unfunded, and forgotten. When you're selling ideas, you have to sell the ideas that will sell. But in a secular age in which the abstraction of science risks replacing all other abstractions, a watered-down, bland, homogeneous version of science is all that will remain if the rhetoric of science is allowed to prosper. We need not choose between God and man, science and philosophy, interpretation and evidence, but ironically, in its quest to prove itself as the supreme form of secular knowledge, science has inadvertently elevated itself into a theology. Science is not a practice so much as an ideology. We don't need to destroy science in order to bring it down to earth, but we do need to bring it down to earth again, and the first step in doing so is to abandon the rhetoric that has become its most popular devotional practice. Our Narrow Definition of Science. Sam Harris, neuroscientist, co-founder and chairman, Project Reason. Author, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religions. Search your mind, or pay attention to the conversations you have with other people, and you'll discover that there are no real boundaries between science and philosophy, or between those disciplines and any other that attempts to make valid claims about the world on the basis of evidence and logic. When such claims and their methods of verification admit of experiment and/or mathematical description, we tend to say our concerns are scientific. When they relate to matters more abstract, or to the consistency of our thinking itself, we often say we're being philosophical. When we merely want to know how people behaved in the past, we dub our interests historical or journalistic. And when a person's commitment to evidence and logic grows dangerously thin, or simply snaps under the burden of fear, wishful thinking, tribalism, or ecstasy, we recognize that he's being religious. The boundaries between true intellectual disciplines are currently enforced by little more than university budgets and architecture. Is the Shroud of Turin a medieval forgery? This is a question of history, of course, and of archaeology, but the techniques of radiocarbon dating make it a question of chemistry and physics as well. The real distinction we should care about, the observation of which is the sine qua non of the scientific attitude, is between demanding good reasons for what one believes and being satisfied with bad ones. The scientific attitude can handle whatever happens to be the case. Indeed, if the evidence for the inerrancy of the Bible and the resurrection of Jesus Christ were good, one could embrace the doctrine of fundamentalist Christianity scientifically. The problem, of course, is that the evidence is either terrible or non-existent, hence the partition we have erected, in practice, never in principle, between science and religion. Confusion on this point has spawned many strange ideas about the nature of human knowledge and the limits of science. People who fear the encroachment of the scientific attitude, especially those who insist upon the dignity of believing in one or another Iron Age god, will often make derogatory use of words such as materialism, neo-Darwinism, and reductionism, as if those doctrines had some necessary connection to science itself. There are, of course, good reasons for scientists to be materialist, neo-Darwinian, and reductionist. However, science entails none of those commitments, nor do they entail one another. If there were evidence for dualism, immaterial souls, reincarnation, one could be a scientist without being a materialist. As it happens, the evidence here is extraordinarily thin, so virtually all scientists are materialists of some sort. If there were evidence against evolution by natural selection, one could be a scientific materialist without being a neo-Darwinist. But, as it happens, the general framework put forward by Darwin is as well established as any other in science. If there were evidence that complex systems produced phenomena that cannot be understood in terms of their constituent parts, it would be possible to be a neo-Darwinist without being a reductionist. For all practical purposes, that's where most scientists find themselves, because every branch of science beyond physics must resort to concepts that cannot be understood merely in terms of particles and fields. Many of us have had philosophical debates about what to make of this explanatory impasse. Does the fact that we cannot predict the behavior of chickens or fledgling democracies on the basis of quantum mechanics mean that those higher-level phenomena are something other than their underlying physics? I would vote no here, but that doesn't mean I envision a time when we'll use only the nouns and verbs of physics to describe the world. But even if one thinks the human mind is entirely the product of physics, the reality of consciousness becomes no less wondrous, and the difference between happiness and suffering no less important. Nor does such a view suggest that we'll ever find the emergence of mind from matter fully intelligible. Consciousness may always seem like a miracle. In philosophical circles, this is known as the hard problem of consciousness. Some of us agree that this problem exists, some of us don't. Should consciousness prove conceptually irreducible, remaining the mysterious ground for all we can conceivably experience or value, the rest of the scientific worldview would remain perfectly intact. The remedy for all this confusion is simple. We must abandon the idea that science is distinct from the rest of human rationality. When you are adhering to the highest standards of logic and evidence, you are thinking scientifically. And when you're not, you're not. The Hard Problem. Daniel C. Dennett, philosopher. Austin B. Fletcher, professor of philosophy, co-director, Center for Cognitive Studies, Tufts University. Co-author, with Linda LaScola, Caught in the Pulpit, Leaving Belief Behind. One might object that the hard problem of consciousness, so dubbed by philosopher David Chalmers in his 1996 book The Conscious Mind, isn't a scientific idea at all, and hence isn't an eligible candidate for this year's Edge question. But since the philosophers who have adopted the term have also persuaded quite a few cognitive scientists that their best scientific work addresses only the easy problems of consciousness, this idea qualifies as scientific. It constrains scientific thinking, distorting scientists' imaginations as they attempt to formulate genuinely scientific theories of consciousness. I won't give examples, since we're instructed to go after ideas, not people, in our answers. No doubt, on first acquaintance, the philosopher's thought experiments succeed handsomely at pumping the intuitions that zombies are conceivable and hence possible, and that this prospect, the mere logical possibility of zombies, shows that there's a hard problem of consciousness untouched by any neuroscientific theories of how consciousness modulates behavioral control, introspective report, emotional responses, etc., etc. But if the scientists impressed by this result from philosophers were to take a good hard look at the critical literature in philosophy exploring the flaws in these thought experiments, they would, I hope, recoil in disbelief. I am embarrassed by the mere thought of them wading through our literature on these topics. You see, the arguments implicit in the simple first-pass thought experiments don't go through without some shoring up. We have to define not just conceivability, but ideal conceivability, and then ideal positive conceivability, as distinct from ideal negative conceivability, etc., etc. Are perpetual motion machines imaginable but ideally inconceivable, or ideally positively conceivable? It makes a big difference, one is told, whether one can modally imagine a zombie. What can you modally imagine, and are you sure? And Franz Jackson's intuition pump about Mary, the color scientist who's prevented from seeing colors, has to be embellished with imaginary gadgets that prevent her from dreaming in color. Or perhaps she's born colorblind, but otherwise with an entirely normal brain. Or perhaps she's fitted with locked-on goggles displaying black-and-white TV to her poor eyeballs. And that's just a fraction of the complicated fantasies that have been earnestly proposed and rebutted. I'm not recommending that scientists do this homework, but if they're curious to see what contortions philosophers will inflict upon themselves in order to save these retrograde intuitions, they could consult the superhumanly patient analysis of Amber Ross of the University of North Carolina, who dismantles the whole tangled mess in her 2013 PhD dissertation, Inconceivable Minds. Is the hard problem an idea that demonstrates the need for a major revolution in science if consciousness is ever to be explained, or an idea that demonstrates the frailty of human imagination? That question is not settled at this time, so scientists should consider adopting the cautious course that postpones all accommodation with it. That's how most neuroscientists handle ESP and psychokinesis, assuming, defeasibly, that they are figments of imagination.
The Neural Correlates of Consciousness. Susan Blackmore, psychologist. Author, Consciousness, An Introduction. Consciousness is a hot topic in neuroscience, and some of the brightest researchers are hunting for the neural correlates of consciousness, NCCs, but they'll never find them. The implicit theory of consciousness underlying this quest is misguided and needs to be retired. The idea of the NCCs is simple enough and intuitively tempting. If we believe in the hard problem of consciousness, the mystery of how subjective experience arises from, or is created by, or generated by, objective events in a brain, then it's easy to imagine that there must be a special place in the brain where this happens. Or if there's no special place, then some kind of consciousness neuron, or process, or pattern, or series of connections. We may not have the first clue how any of these objective things could produce subjective experience, but if we could identify which of them was responsible, so the thinking goes, we'd be one step closer to solving the mystery. This sounds eminently sensible, as it means taking the well-worn scientific route of starting with correlations before moving on to causal explanations. The trouble is, it depends on a dualist and ultimately unworkable theory of consciousness. The underlying intuition is that consciousness is an extra, something additional to and different from the physical processes on which it depends. Searching for the NCCs relies on this difference. On one side of the correlation, you measure neural processes using EEG, fMRI, or other kinds of brain scan. On the other, you measure subjective experiences or consciousness itself. But how? A popular method is to use binocular rivalry, or ambiguous figures that can be seen in either of two incompatible ways, such as a Necker cube that flips between two orientations. To find the NCCs, you find out which version is being consciously perceived as the perception flips from one to the other, and then you correlate that with what's happening in the visual system. The problem is that the person has to tell you in words, "Now I am conscious of this," or "Now I'm now conscious of that." They might instead press a lever or button, and other animals can do this too, but in every case, you're measuring physical responses. Is this capturing something called unconsciousness? Will it help us solve the mystery? No. This method is really no different from any other correlational studies of brain function, such as correlating activity in the fusiform face area with seeing faces, or in the prefrontal cortex with certain kinds of decision-making. It correlates one type of physical measure with another. This isn't useless research. It's interesting to know, for example, where in the visual system neural activity changes when the reported visual experience flips. But discovering this doesn't tell us that this neural activity is the generator of something special called consciousness or subjective experience, while everything else going on in the brain is unconscious. I can understand the temptation to think it is. Dualist thinking comes naturally to us. We feel as though our conscious experiences were of a different order from the physical world. But this is the same intuition that leads to the hard problem seeming hard. It's the same intuition that produces the philosopher's zombie, a creature identical to me in every way except that it has no consciousness. It's the same intuition that leads people to write, apparently unproblematically, about brain processes being either conscious or unconscious. Am I really denying this difference? Yes. Intuitively plausible as it is, this is a magic difference. Consciousness is not some weird and wonderful product of some brain processes, but not others. Rather, it's an illusion constructed by a clever brain and body in a complex social world. We can speak, think, refer to ourselves as agents, and so build up the false idea of a persisting self that has consciousness and free will. We're tricked by an odd feature of consciousness. When I ask myself, What am I conscious of now? I can always find an answer. It's the trees outside the window, the sound of the wind, the problem I'm worried about and cannot solve, or whatever seems most vivid at the time. This is what I mean by being conscious now, by having qualia. But what was happening a moment before I asked? When I look back, I can use memories to claim I was conscious of this or that and not conscious of something else, relying on the clarity, logic, consistency, and other such features to decide. This leads all too easily to the idea that while people are awake, they must always be conscious of something or other. And that leads along the slippery path to the idea that if we knew what to look for, we could peer inside someone's brain and find out which processes were the conscious ones and which were the unconscious ones. But this is all nonsense. All we'll ever find are the neural correlates of thoughts, perceptions, memories, and the verbal and attentional processes that lead us to think we're conscious. When we finally have a better theory of consciousness to replace these popular delusions, we'll see that there's no hard problem, no magic difference, and no NCCs.
Long-term memory is immutable. Todd C. Sactor, Professor of Physiology and Pharmacology, Professor of Neurology, State University of New York, Downstate Medical Center. For over a century, psychological theory held that once memories are consolidated from short-term into long-term form, they remain stable and unchanging. Whether certain long-term memories are slowly forgotten or are always present but cannot be retrieved was a matter of debate. For the last 50 years, research on the neurobiological basis of memory seemed to support the psychological theory. Short-term memory was found to be mediated by biochemical changes at synapses, modifying their strength. Long-term memory was strongly correlated with long-term changes in the number of synapses, either increases or decreases. This intuitively made sense. Biochemical changes were rapid and could be quickly reversed, just like short-term memories. On the other hand, synapses, although small, were anatomical structures visible under the microscope and thus were thought to be stable for weeks, perhaps for years. Short-term memories could easily be prevented from consolidating into the long term by dozens of inhibitors of different signaling molecules. In contrast, there was no known agent that erased a long-term memory. Two recent lines of evidence show this dominant theory of long-term memory to be ready for retirement. The first is the discovery of reconsolidation. When memories are recalled, they undergo a brief period in which they're once again susceptible to disruption by many of the same biochemical inhibitors that affect the initial conversion of short into long-term memory. This means that long-term memories are not immutable, but can be converted into short-term memory and then reconverted back into long-term memory. If this reconversion doesn't happen, the specific long-term memory is effectively disrupted. The second is the discovery of a few agents that do indeed erase long-term memories. These include inhibitors of the persistently active enzyme PKM-zeta and of a protein translation factor with prion-like properties of perpetuation. Conversely, increasing the activity of the molecules enhances old memories. The persistent changes in synapse number that so strongly correlate with long-term memory may therefore be downstream of persistent biochemical changes. That memory-erasing agents are so few suggests that there may be a relatively simple mechanism for long-term memory storage involving not hundreds of molecules, as in short-term memory, but only a handful, perhaps working together. Memory reconsolidation allows specific long-term memories to be manipulated. Memory erasure is extraordinarily potent and likely disrupts many, if not all, long-term memories at the same time. When these two fields are combined, specific long-term memories will be erased or strengthened in ways never conceivable in prior theories. The Self. Bruce Hood, Professor of Developmental Psychology and Society, School of Experimental Psychology, University of Bristol, UK. Author, The Self Illusion. It seems almost redundant to call for the retirement of the free-willing self, as the idea is neither scientific, nor is this the first time the concept has been dismissed for lack of empirical support. The self did not have to be discovered. It's the default assumption most of us experience, so it wasn't really revealed by methods of scientific inquiry. Challenging the notion of a self is also not new. Freud's unconscious ego has been dismissed for lack of empirical support since the cognitive revolution of the 1950s. Yet the self, like a conceptual zombie, refuses to die. It crops up again and again in recent theories of decision-making as an entity with free will which can be depleted. It reappears as an interpreter in cognitive neuroscience, as able to integrate parallel streams of information arising from separable neural substrates. Even if these appearances of the self are understood to be convenient ways of discussing the emergent output of multiple parallel processes, students of the mind continue to implicitly endorse the idea that there's a decision maker, an experiencer, a point of origin. We know the self is constructed because it can be so easily deconstructed through damage, disease, and drugs. It must be an emergent property of a parallel system processing input, output, and internal representations. It's an illusion because it feels so real, but that experience is not what it seems. The same is true for free will. Although we can experience the mental anguish of making a decision, our free will cannot be some kind of King Solomon in our minds, weighing the pros and cons, as this would present the problem of logical infinite regress. Who is inside his head? And so on. The choices and decisions we make are based on situations that impose on us. We don't have the free will to choose the experiences that have shaped our decisions. Should we really care about the self? After all, trying to live without the self is challenging and not how we think. By experiencing, evoking, and talking about the self, we're conveniently addressing a phenomenology we can all relate to. Defaulting to the self in explanations of human behavior enables us to draw an abrupt stop in the chain of causality when trying to understand thoughts and actions. How notable that one does this so easily when talking about humans, but when one applies the same approach to animals, one is accused of anthropomorphism. By abandoning the free-willing self, we're forced to re-examine the factors that are truly behind our thoughts and behavior and the way they interact, balance, override, and cancel out. Only then will we begin to make progress in understanding how we really operate. Cognitive Agency. Thomas Metzinger, philosopher, Johannes Gutenberg Universität Mainz. Author, The Ego Tunnel. Thinking isn't something you do. Most of the time, it's something that happens to you. Cutting-edge research on the phenomenon of mind-wandering clearly shows how almost all of us, for more than two-thirds of our conscious lifetime, are not in control of our conscious thought processes. Western culture, traditional philosophy of mind, and even cognitive neuroscience have been deeply influenced by the myth of cognitive agency. It's the myth of the Cartesian ego, the active thinker of thoughts, the epistemic subject that acts, mentally, rationally, in a goal-directed manner, and can always terminate or suspend its own cognitive processing at will. It's the theory that conscious thought is a personal-level process, something that by necessity has to be ascribed to you, the person as a whole. This theory has now been empirically refuted. As it turns out, most of our conscious thoughts are actually the product of subpersonal processes, like breathing or the peristaltic movements in our gastrointestinal tract. The myth of cognitive agency, says that we're mentally autonomous beings. We can now see that this is an old, complacent fairy tale. It's time to put it to rest. Recent studies in the booming research field of mind wandering show that we spend roughly two-thirds of our conscious lifetime zoning out, daydreaming, lost in fantasies, autobiographical planning, inner narratives, or depressive rumination. Depending on the study, 30 to 50% of our waking life is occupied by spontaneously occurring stimulus and task-unrelated thought. Mind wandering probably has positive aspects too, because it's associated with creativity, careful future planning, or the encoding of long-term memories. But its overall performance costs, for example, in terms of reading comprehension, memory, sustained attention tasks, or working memory, are marked and have been well documented. So have its negative effects on general subjective well-being. A wandering mind is an unhappy mind, but it may only be part of a more comprehensive process beyond the conscious self's control or understanding. The sudden loss of inner autonomy, which all of us experience many hundreds of times every day, seems to be based on a cyclically recurring process in the brain. The ebb and flow of autonomy and meta-awareness might well be a kind of attentional seesawing between our inner and outer worlds, caused by a constant competition between the brain networks underlying spontaneous subpersonal thinking and goal-oriented cognition. Mind wandering is not the only way in which our attention gets decoupled from perception of the here and now. There are also periods of mind blanking. These episodes often may not be remembered and also frequently escape detection by external observers. In addition, there's clearly complex but uncontrollable cognitive phenomenology during sleep. Adults spend approximately 1.5 to 2 hours per night in REM sleep, experiencing dreams in which they're mostly unable to control their conscious thought process. NREM, non-rapid eye movement sleep, yields similar dreamlike reports during stage 1, whereas other stages of NREM sleep are characterized by mostly cognitive symbolic mentation that is typically confused, non-progressive, and perseverative. A conservative estimate would therefore be that for much more than half our lifetime, we're not cognitive agents in the true sense of the word. This excludes periods of illness, intoxication, or insomnia, in which people suffer from dysfunctional forms of cognitive control, such as thought suppression, worry, rumination, and counterfactual imagery, and are plagued by intrusive thoughts, feelings of regret, shame, and guilt. We don't yet know when and how children acquire a conscious self-model that permits controlled rational thought. But another sad yet empirically plausible assumption is that most of us gradually lose cognitive autonomy toward the end of life. Interestingly, the neural correlate of non-autonomous conscious thought overlaps to a considerable degree with ongoing activity in what neuroscientists call the default mode network. One global function of mind wandering might be called autobiographical self-model maintenance. Mind wandering creates an adaptive form of self-deception, namely an illusion of personal identity across time. It helps maintain a fictional self that then lays the foundation for important achievements like reward prediction or delay discounting. As a philosopher, my conceptual point is that only if an organism stimulates itself as being one and the same across time will it be able to represent reward events or the achievement of goals as a fulfillment of its own goals, as happening to the same entity. I like to call this the principle of virtual identity formation. Many higher forms of intelligence and adaptive behavior, including risk management, moral cognition, and cooperative social behavior, functionally presuppose a self-model that portrays the organism as a single entity enduring over time. Because we are really only cognitive systems, that is, complex processes without any precise identity criteria, the formation of an illusory identity across time can be achieved only on a virtual level, for example, through the creation of an automatic narrative. This could be the more fundamental and overarching computational goal of mind wandering, and one it may share with dreaming. If I'm right, the default mode of the autobiographical self-modeling constructs a domain-general functional platform enabling long-term motivation and future planning. Mental autonomy, and how it can be improved, will be one of the hottest topics for the future. There's even a deep link between mental and political autonomy. You cannot sustain one without the other. Because there are not only bodily actions but also mental actions, autonomy has to do with freedom, in one of the deepest and most fundamental senses of the word. But the ability to act autonomously implies more than reasons, arguments, and rationality. Much more fundamentally, it refers to the ability to willfully inhibit, suspend, or terminate our own actions, bodily, social, or mental. The breakdown of this ability is what we call mind-wandering. It's not an inner action at all, but a form of unintentional behavior, an involuntary form of mental activity. Free will. Jerry Coyne, Professor, Department of Ecology and Evolution, University of Chicago. Author, Why Evolution is True. Among virtually all scientists, dualism is dead. Our thoughts and actions are the outputs of a computer made of meat, our brain, a computer that must obey the laws of physics. Our choices, therefore, must also obey those laws. This puts paid to the traditional idea of dualistic or libertarian free will, that our lives comprise a series of decisions in which we could have chosen otherwise. We know now that we can never do otherwise, and we know it in two ways. The first is from scientific experience, which shows no evidence for a mind separate from the physical brain. This means that I, whatever I means, may have the illusion of choosing, but my choices are in principle predictable by the laws of physics, excepting any quantum indeterminacy that acts in my neurons. In short, the traditional notion of free will, defined by the biologist Anthony Cashmore as a belief that there is a component to biological behavior that is something more than the unavoidable consequences of the genetic and environmental history of the individual and the possible stochastic laws of nature, is dead on arrival. Second, recent experiments support the idea that our decisions often precede our consciousness of having made them. Increasingly sophisticated studies using brain scanning show that those scans can often predict the choices one will make several seconds before the subject is conscious of having chosen. Indeed, our feeling of making a choice may itself be a post hoc confabulation, perhaps an evolved one. When pressed, nearly all scientists and most philosophers admit this. Determinism and materialism, they agree, win the day. But they're remarkably quiet about it. Instead of spreading the important scientific message that our behaviors are the deterministic results of a physical process, they'd rather invent new, compatibilist versions of free will, versions that comport with determinism. Well, when we order strawberry ice cream, we really couldn't have ordered vanilla, they say, but we still have free will in another sense, and it's the only sense that's important. Unfortunately, what's important differs among philosophers. Some say that what's important is that our complex brain evolved to absorb many inputs and run them through complex programs, ruminations, before giving an output, decision. Others say that what's important is that it's our own brain and nobody else's that makes our decisions, even if those decisions are predetermined. Some even argue that we have free will because most of us choose without duress. Nobody holds a gun to our head and says, "Order the strawberry." But of course that's not true. The guns are the electrical signals in our brain. In the end, there's nothing free about compatibilist free will. It's a semantic game in which choice becomes an illusion, something that isn't what it seems. Whether or not we can choose is a matter for science, not philosophy, And science tells us that we're complex marionettes dancing to the strings of our genes and environments. Philosophy, watching the show, says, "Pay attention to me, for I have changed the game." So why does the term free will still hang around when science has destroyed its conventional meaning? Some compatibilists, perhaps, are impressed by their feeling that they can choose and must comport this with science. Others have said explicitly that characterizing free will as an illusion will hurt society. If people believe they're puppets, well, then maybe they'll be crippled by nihilism, lacking the will to leave their beds. This attitude reminds me of the probably apocryphal statement of the Bishop of Worcester's wife when she heard about Darwin's theory. "My dear, descended from the apes, let us hope it is not true, but if it is, let us pray it will not become generally known." What puzzles me is why compatibilists spend so much time trying to harmonize determinism with a historically non-deterministic concept instead of tackling the harder but more important task of selling the public on the scientific notions of materialism, naturalism, and their consequence. The mind is produced by the brain. These consequences of incompatibilism mean a complete rethinking of how we punish and reward people. When we realize that the person who kills because of a mental disorder had precisely as much choice as someone who murders from childhood abuse or a bad environment, we'll see that everyone deserves the mitigation now given only to those deemed unable to choose between right and wrong. For if our actions are predetermined, none of us can make that choice. Punishment for crimes will still be needed, of course, to deter others, rehabilitate offenders, and remove criminals from society. But now this can be put on a more scientific footing. What interventions can best help both society and the offender? And we lose the useless idea of justice as retribution. Accepting incompatibilism also dissolves the notion of moral responsibility. Yes, we're responsible for our actions, but only in the sense that they're committed by an identifiable individual. But if you can't really choose to be good or bad, to punch someone or save a drowning child, what do we mean by moral responsibility? Some may argue that getting rid of that idea also jettisons an important social good. I claim the opposite. By rejecting moral responsibility, we're free to judge actions not by some dictate, divine or otherwise, but by their consequences, what's good or bad for society. Finally, rejecting free will means rejecting the fundamental tenets of the many religions that depend on freely choosing a god or a savior. The fears motivating some compatibilists that a version of free will must be maintained lest society collapse won't be realized. The illusion of agency is so powerful that even strong incompatibilists like myself will always act as if we had choices, even though we know we don't. We have no choice in this matter. But we can at least ponder why evolution might have bequeathed us such a powerful illusion. Common Sense. Robert Provine, neuroscientist, Emeritus Professor of Psychology, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Author, Curious Behavior. We fancy ourselves intelligent, conscious, and alert, thinking our way through life. This is an illusion. We're deluded by our brain's generation of a sketchy, rational narrative of subconscious, sometimes irrational or fictitious events that we accept as reality. These narratives are so compelling that they become common sense, and we use them to guide our lives. In cases of brain damage, neurologists use the term confabulation to describe a patient's game but flawed attempt to produce an accurate narrative of life events. I suggest we be equally wary of everyday, non-pathological confabulation and retire the common sense hypothesis that we're rational beings in full conscious control of our lives. Indeed, we may be passengers in our body, just going along for the ride, and privy only to second-hand knowledge of our status, course, and destination. Behavioral and brain science detect chinks in our synthetic, neurologically generated edifice of reality. Research on sensory illusions indicates that percepts are simply our best estimate of the nature of physical stimuli, not a precise rendering of things and events. The image of our own body is an oddly shaped product of brain function. Memory of things past is also fraught with uncertainty. It's not the reading out of information from the brain's neurological data bank, but an ongoing construct subject to error and bias. The brain also makes decisions and initiates action before the observer is consciously aware of detecting and responding to stimuli. My own research found that people confabulate narratives to rationalize their laughter, such as, "It was funny," or "I was embarrassed," neglecting laughter's involuntary nature and frequent contagiousness. Our lives are guided by a series of these guesstimates about the behavior and mental state of ourselves and others, guesstimates that, although imperfect, are adaptive and sufficiently accurate to enable us to muddle along. However, as scientists, we demand more than default explanations based on common sense. Behavioral and brain science provide a path to understanding that challenges the myths of mental life and everyday behavior. One of its delights is that reality is often turned on its head, revealing hidden processes and providing revelations about who we are, what we're doing, and where we're going. There Can Be No Science of Art. Jonathan Gottschall, Distinguished Research Fellow, English Department, Washington and Jefferson College, author, The Storytelling Animal. 15,000 years ago in France, a sculptor swam and slithered almost a kilometer down into a mountain cave. Using clay, the artist shaped a big bull rearing to mount a cow and then left his creation in the bowels of the earth. The two bison of the Tuc-d'Audebert caves sat undisturbed until they were discovered by spelunking boys in 1912, one of many shocking 20th-century discoveries of sophisticated cave art stretching back tens of thousands of years. The discoveries overturned our sense of what our caveman ancestors were like. They weren't furry, grunting troglodytes. They had artistic souls. They showed us that humans are, by nature, not just by culture, art-making, art-consuming, art-addicted apes. But why? Why did the sculptor burrow into the earth, make art, and leave it there in the dark? And why does art exist in the first place? Scholars have spun a lot of stories in answer to such questions, but the truth is that we don't know. Here's one reason. Science is lying down on the job. A long time ago, someone proclaimed that art couldn't be studied scientifically, and for some reason, almost everyone believed it. The humanities and sciences constituted, as Stephen Jay Gould might have proclaimed, separate, non-overlapping magisteria, the tools of one radically unsuited to the other. Science has mostly bought into this. How else can we explain its neglect of the arts? People live in art. We read stories and watch them on TV and listen to them in song. We make paintings and gaze at them. We beautify our homes like bowerbirds adorning nests. We demand beauty in the products we buy, which explains the gleam of our automobiles and the sleek, modernist aesthetic of our iPhones. We make art out of our own bodies, sculpting them through diet and exercise, festooning them with jewelry and colorful garments, using our skin as living canvas for the display of tattoos. So it is the world over. As the late Dennis Dutton argued in The Art Instinct, underneath the cultural variations, all human beings have essentially the same art. Our curious love affair with art sets our species apart as much as our sapience or our language or our use of tools. And yet we understand so little about art. We don't know why it exists in the first place. We don't know why we crave beauty. We don't know how art produces its effects in our brains, why one arrangement of sound or color pleases while another cloys. We don't know much about the precursors of art in other species, and we don't know when humans became creatures of art. According to one influential theory, art arrived 50,000 years ago in a kind of creative Big Bang. If that's true, how did it happen? We don't even have a good definition, in truth, for what art is. In short, there's nothing so central to human life that's so incompletely understood. Recent years have seen more use of scientific tools and methods in the humanities. Neuroscientists can show us what's happening in the brain when we enjoy a song or study a painting. Psychologists are studying how novels and TV shows shape our politics or our morality. Evolutionary psychologists and literary scholars are teaming up to explore narratives' Darwinian origins. Other literary scholars are developing a digital humanities, using algorithms to extract big data from digitized literature. But scientific work in the humanities has mainly been scattered, preliminary, and desultory. It doesn't constitute a research program. If we want better answers to fundamental questions about art, science must jump into the game with both feet. Going it alone, humanities scholars can tell intriguing stories about the origins and significance of art, but they don't have the tools to patiently winnow the field of competing ideas. That's what the scientific method is for, separating the more accurate stories from the less accurate stories. But a strong science of art will require both the thick, granular expertise of humanities scholars and the clever hypothesis testing of scientists. I'm not calling for a scientific takeover of the arts. I'm calling for a partnership. This partnership faces great obstacles. There's the unexamined assumption that something about art makes it science-proof. There's the widespread, if usually unspoken, belief that art is just a frill in human life, relatively unimportant compared to the weighty stuff of science. And there's the weird idea that science necessarily destroys the beauty it seeks to explain, as though a learned astronomer could dull the starshine. But the Delphic admonition, "Know thyself," still rings out as the great prime directive of intellectual inquiry, and there will always be a gaping hole in human self-knowledge until we develop a science of art. Science and Technology. George Dyson, science historian, author, Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. The phrase science and technology presumes an inseparability that may not be as secure as we think. There can be science without technology, and there can be technology without science. Pure mathematics is one example, from the Pythagoreans to Japanese temple geometry, of a science flourishing without technology. Imperial China developed sophisticated technologies while neglecting science, and it's all too easy to imagine a society that embraces technology but represses science until only technology remains. Or one particular species of technology might achieve such dominance that it halts the advance of science in order to preserve itself. That science has brought us technology does not mean that technology will always bring us science. Science could go into retirement at any time. Retiring the assumption that as long as technology flourishes, so will science, might help us avoid this mistake. Things are either true or false. Alan Alda, actor, writer, director, host of the PBS program Brains on Trial, author, Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself. The idea that things are either true or false should possibly take a rest. I'm not a scientist, just a lover of science, so I might be speaking out of turn. But like all lovers, I think about my beloved a lot. I want her to be free and productive and not misunderstood. For me, the trouble with truth is that not only is the notion of eternal, universal truth highly questionable, but simple, local truths are subject to refinement as well. Up is up and down is down, of course. Except under certain circumstances. Is the North Pole up and the South Pole down? Is someone standing at one of the poles right side up or upside down? Kind of depends on your perspective. When I studied how to think in school, I was taught that the first rule of logic was that a thing cannot both be and not be at the same time and in the same respect. That last note, in the same respect, says a lot. As soon as you change the frame of reference, you've changed the truthiness of a once immutable fact. Death seems pretty definite. The body is just a lump. Life is gone. But if you step back a bit, the body is actually in a transitional phase while it slowly turns into compost, capable of living in another way. This is not to say that nothing is true or that everything is possible, just that it might not be so helpful for things to be known as true for all time without a disclaimer. At the moment, the way it's presented to us, astrology is highly unlikely to be true. But if it turns out that organic stuff once bounced off Mars and hit Earth with a dose of life, we might have to revise some statements that planets don't influence our lives here on Earth. I wonder, and this is just a modest proposal, whether scientific truth should be identified in a way acknowledging that it's something we know and understand for now, and in a certain way. The public comes to mistrust science when they feel that scientists can't make up their minds. One says red wine is good for you, and another says even in small amounts it can be harmful. In truth, some people think science is just another belief system. Scientists and science writers make a real effort to deal with this all the time. The phrase, "current research suggests," warns us that it's not a fact yet. But from time to time, the full-blown factualness of something is declared, even though further work could place it within a new frame of reference. And then the public might wonder if the scientists are just arguing for their pet ideas. Facts, it seems to me, are workable units, useful in a given frame or context. They should be as exact and irrefutable as possible, tested by experiment to the fullest extent. When the frame changes, they don't need to be discarded as untrue, but respected as still useful within their domain. Most people who work with facts accept this, but I don't think the public fully gets it. That's why I hope for more wariness about implying we know something to be true or false for all time and for everywhere in the cosmos. Simple Answers. Gavin Schmidt, climatologist, director, NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. More precisely, the notion that there are simple answers to complex problems. The universe is complicated. Whether you're interested in the functioning of a cell, the ecosystem in Amazonia, the climate of the Earth, or the solar dynamo, almost all the systems and their effects on our lives are complex and multifaceted. It's natural for us to ask simple questions about these systems, and many of our greatest insights have come from the profound examination of such simple questions. However, the answers that have come back are never as simple. The answer in the real world is never 42. Yet collectively, we keep acting as though there were simple answers. We continually read about the search for the one method that will let us cut through the confusion, the one piece of data that tells us the truth, or the final experiment that will prove the hypothesis. But most scientists agree that these are fool's errands, that science is a method for producing incrementally useful approximations to reality, not a path to absolute truth. In contrast, our public discourse is dominated by voices equating clarity with seeing things as either good or bad, day or night, black or white. They're not ignoring just the shades of gray. They're missing out on the whole wonderful, multi-hued spectrum. By demanding simple answers to complex questions, we rob the questions of the qualities that make them interesting. Scientists sometimes play into this limiting frame when we craft our press releases or pitch our popular science books, and in truth, it's hard to avoid. But we should be more vigilant. The world is complex, and we need to embrace that complexity to have any hope of finding robust answers to the simple questions we will inevitably continue to ask. We'll never hit barriers to scientific understanding. Martin Rees, former president, Royal Society, emeritus professor of cosmology and astrophysics, University of Cambridge, master, Trinity College, author, From Here to Infinity. There's a widely held presumption that our insight will deepen indefinitely, that all scientific problems will eventually yield to attack. But we may need to abandon this optimism. The human intellect may hit the buffers, even though, in most fields of science, there's surely a long way to go before that happens. There is plainly unfinished business in cosmology. Einstein's theory treats space and time as smooth and continuous. We know, however, that no material can be chopped into arbitrarily small pieces. Eventually, you get down to discrete atoms. Likewise, space itself has a grainy and quantized structure, but on a scale a trillion trillion times smaller. We lack a unified understanding of the bedrock of the physical world. Such a theory would bring big bangs and multiverses within the remit of rigorous science, but it wouldn't signal the end of discovery. Indeed, it would be irrelevant to the 99% of scientists who are neither particle physicists nor cosmologists. Our grasp of diet and childcare, for instance, is still so meager that expert advice changes from year to year. This may seem in incongruous contrast to the confidence with which we can discuss galaxies and subatomic particles. But biologists are held up by the problems of complexity, and these are more daunting than those of the very big and the very small. The sciences are sometimes likened to different levels of a tall building. Particle physics on the ground floor, then the rest of physics, then chemistry, and so forth, all the way up to psychology, and the economists in the penthouse. There's a corresponding hierarchy of complexity. Atoms, molecules, cells, organisms, and so forth. This metaphor is in some ways helpful. It illustrates how each science is pursued independently of the others. But in one key respect, the analogy is poor. In a building, insecure foundations imperil the floors above. But the higher-level sciences dealing with complex systems aren't imperiled by an insecure base, as a building is. Each science has its own distinct concepts and explanations. Even if we had a hypercomputer that could solve Schrödinger's equation for quadrillions of atoms, its output wouldn't yield the kind of understanding that most scientists seek. This is true not only of the sciences that deal with really complex things, especially those things that are alive, but even when the phenomena are more mundane. For instance, mathematicians trying to understand why taps drip or why waves break don't care that water is H2O. They treat the fluid as a continuum. They use emergent concepts like viscosity and turbulence. Nearly all scientists are reductionists, insofar as they think that everything, however complicated, obeys the basic equations of physics. But even if a hypercomputer could solve Schrödinger's equation for the immense aggregate of atoms in, say, breaking waves, migrating birds, or tropical forests, an atomic-level explanation wouldn't yield the enlightenment we really seek. The brain is an assemblage of cells, and a painting is an assemblage of chemical pigment, but in both cases, what's interesting is the pattern and structure, the emergent complexity. We humans haven't changed much since our remote ancestors roamed the African savanna. Our brains evolved to cope with the human-scale environment, so it's surely remarkable that we can make sense of phenomena that confound everyday intuition, in particular, the minuscule atoms we're made of and the vast cosmos that surrounds us. Nonetheless, and here I'm sticking my neck out, maybe some aspects of reality are intrinsically beyond us, in that their comprehension would require some post-human intellect, just as Euclidean geometry is beyond non-human primates. Some may contest this proposition by pointing out that there's no limit to what's computable. But being computable isn't the same as being conceptually graspable. To give a trivial example, anyone who has learned Cartesian geometry can readily visualize a simple pattern, a line or a circle, when given the equation for it. But nobody, given the simple-seeming algorithm for drawing the Mandelbrot set, could visualize its amazing intricacies, even though drawing the pattern is only a modest task for a computer. It would be unduly anthropocentric to believe that all of science, and a proper concept of all aspects of reality, is within human mental powers to grasp. Whether the really long-range future lies with organic post-humans or with intelligent machines is a matter for debate. But either way, there will be insights into reality left for them to discover.